Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
It can be argued that in the world of sports, there is no trophy more storied than the Stanley Cup. It can also be argued that no trophy has been more creatively and consistently abused. In Then Wayne Said to Mario, the best Stanley Cup stories ever told, Kevin Allen intentionally makes the former argument while providing evidence for those who favor the latter. When I spoke recently with Kevin Allen, he told me all sorts of stories related to the Cup itself and to the pursuit of same. I began our conversation by asking him how the National Hockey League goes about ensuring that the Stanley Cup is at least sometimes treated with the, quote, reverence and dignity it is supposed to deserve.
Well, it's interesting. The reason why I wrote this book is I've always loved sort of the mixed reaction and feelings that players have about the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. On one hand, there is a religious reverence to it. You know, if they have not won the cup, they won't be pictured with the cup. They won't touch the cup. Almost there's a superstition about it, and it's held in such high regard. And it's almost viewed as a vision quest. you know, you work on it your entire career trying to win that cup. You know, when players pursue this cup, it is an overwhelming desire to win it. And the cup itself weighs about 34 pounds. And yet I've had players tell me that even though, you know, most of them can bench press 250 or 300 pounds, that the weight seems staggering after it's over because their knees are weak and their arms are weak. Mm-hmm. And I know Dallas Drake, you know, who waited 17 years to win the cup with Detroit, told me that he was quivering when he tried to raise it. On the other hand, when they do win it, you know, they're allowed to let their hair down with the cup, and it's celebrated, and they will do almost anything with that cup in the name of celebrating. There have been many different materials and items and things that have been placed in that cup through the years.
Well, we'll get to some of those stories, but the league does have a guy who sort of chaperones the cup, and he has to wear white gloves and everything, right?
Well, absolutely. You know, when they bring it on the ice, it's always where they're wearing white gloves, and it's always, you know, shined. And at the end of each summer after the players have toured with it, it goes back to the silversmith who not only engraves the winner's names, but also, you know, repairs the cup. And it's usually in need of repair because it's had a hearty, fun-filled summer. And what a lot of people don't realize is there are actually two Stanley Cups. There is a replica Stanley Cup. And when I tell this story, fans generally believe, well, the one that the players party with must not be the original. But that's not true. In 1995, Commissioner Gary Bettman decreed that, you know, the quest to win the cup, the gauntlet that needs to be run in order to accomplish that, is too arduous to give them a replica. So he said, players get the real cup, and when you go to the Hall of Fame in Toronto in the summertime, when the players have the cup, what the fans see is the replica, because the real cup is being toured about, and it's you know, in swimming pools and used as bait buckets and being celebrated with by the players.
Well, as you say, some of the most enjoyable stories in your book involve occasions where the Stanley Cup was abused, mislaid, and dented or otherwise damaged. Have you a favorite among those stories?
Well, I sure do, and it goes back to the celebration in 1992 when the Penguins had won, and they all gathered at Mary Lemieux's house for a celebration. And at that point, the party was rather tame till about 3 in the morning when Phil Bourque, no relation to Ray Bourque, stood up on a waterfall that Mario had near his pool, an artificial waterfall, and pushed the cup up like he was King Kong. It was over his head, and much to the chagrin of everyone around, he hurled it in the pool. Now, that was good fun, and everyone had a laugh until they realized that it formed a suction on the bottom of the pool, and it took 3.5 hours for the players to get it off the ice. They essentially had to form diving teams.
You mean to get it out of the pool?
Yeah, absolutely, because it formed right in a suction on the bottom. And the next day, if you look at pictures of the parade and the celebration with the cup, players are always holding it rather gingerly because they were afraid that one good yank and the cup was going to come off because it was quite a struggle to get it out of the pool. But I think, again, that sort of shows the sort of contradiction because, you know, the cup is revered. It really is. And yet, on the other hand, once you win it, you're entitled then to, you know, rock the house with it.
Lots of the stories in your book are not about the cup itself, but about how various teams pursued it. Tell us about how Coach Punch Imlach motivated his 1967 Toronto Maple Leafs as they reached the final games of their quest.
He came in with a big pile of money and laid it in the locker room and said, you know, all of this could be yours. And what's sometimes forgotten in this era when, you know, the average player's salary is, you know, $2 million is that back then they were not making a lot of money. They had to work in the off season even to make a living. And when he laid, you know, $100,000 out in front of them, you know, everyone looked at that and they were motivated. And, you know, that was a common occurrence. You know, the Red Wing organization, Jack Adams at the end of the season when they won the cup, and they won several in the 1950s, he would have envelopes for players and he would go around and give them money. But, you know, when you ask the players who won the cup in the 1940s and 50s, to them, you know, the celebration is not the same as it was today. I mean, then the next day they looked in the paper to see what the GM was saying about how the team was going to be rebuilt the following year. They weren't touring the countryside with the Stanley Cup.
Part of the fun of this book comes from what you have to say about the history of the National Hockey League. For instance, you contend that back in 1940, and I'm quoting here, NHL contests were considered high-class entertainment. And one of the players you interviewed, Clint Smith of the 1940 Rangers, recalled that fans would attend those games in tuxedos. Did they loosen their ties and scream for fights in those days, too?
I'm fearful they did. I don't know for sure. And that tradition continued into the 1950s and 60s, and that's in all cities. You know, in Detroit, for example, at Olympia Stadium, any of the pictures that you see, you know, from that era, anyone in the lower bowl would be in a suit and a tie, and the women would be, you know, in their finest. And it was very much a family game. You know, men brought their wives to the game, and the wives were interested in the game, and it was considered a, you know, social event.
Derek Sanderson played in the Stanley Cup Finals in 1970 and 1972, and among the intriguing statistics in your book, my favorite is that when Derek Sanderson was 11 years old, the Boston Bruins gave Sanderson's family $100 to ensure that he'd be on something called their protected list. That can't have been legal, can it?
Well, back then it was. You know, that you were really owned by the franchises. And, you know, if you didn't behave yourself, you could quickly be out of the game. You know, they were very fearful, players were, of being blackballed or ostracized. Because, you know, if they wanted you out of the game, you could be out of the game. But, you know, in Sanderson's case, back when there was going to be a big junior contest in Boston, and it included, you know, big Bruins prospects Sanderson and Orr, Sanderson's father told him, hey, you know, in this game, there's only going to be two players that everyone's talking about. There's going to be Bobby Orr and the player who fought Bobby Orr. And, of course, Sanderson went out and took his father's advice and got involved in a little scrap with Bobby Orr. And sure enough, the next day, what everyone was talking about was, you know, the kid who fought Bobby Orr.
The Cup may have mystical powers, as you suggest at a couple of points. Phil Bourque, who played on that Penguins team that won the Cup, a matter of fact, the same guy that threw it into Mario's pool, said at one point in the book, on every team you have your millionaires club, and then you have the guys swimming at the bottom. I wonder, does the Stanley Cup or the pursuit of the Cup bring those factions together?
Oh, absolutely. And often they're bonded, that I've found, particularly, I would say, in the last 15 years, they're bonded by, there's someone that's usually picked out as having not won a cup that we're trying to win it for. And I go back, certainly, in Colorado when the Avalanche won it for Ray Bourque. You know, in 2003, Tampa Bay won it for Dave Vanderchuk, who had played more games than anyone without winning a cup. The Red Wings, they talked about winning one for Dallas Drake, who, you know, is one of those bottom feeders, one of the guys who throws himself in front of shots. And what's interesting about the Dallas Drake situation, and I think it's so common in the pursuit of the cup, when he was acquired, I remember distinctly fans talking about, you know, why did they need him? His best days were behind him. And he didn't play particularly well during the regular season. But when the playoffs started and he was pursuing the cup, suddenly he became a shot-blocking machine. He was like the Bob Goldham of this era. You know, Bob Goldham was the best shot blocker probably ever. And suddenly Dallas Drake was making exceptional plays and playing more minutes than he played in the regular season. And I think that happens a lot. And I think Bourque was onto something when he said, that, you know, everybody comes together, because there's no role that's less important than another role. The big shot blocker in the pursuit of the cup is as important as the 50-goal scorer. And players understand that. And I think, you know, the idea of chemistry and hockey and team unity, I think it's much more critical than other sports, and I really believe that.
I don't know which of the various indignities suffered by the cup was most inglorious, but would you say doing service as the breakfast dish for a horse would be right up there?
Well, absolutely, though Eddie Olczyk, who is pictured in the famed photo that shows him feeding a thoroughbred, has insisted, and he did insist in for my book, that that was a staged event and that the horse never actually ate out of the cup. But saying all that, so what if he did? I mean, you know, this is, you know, we've had a monkey in the Stanley Cup. It's been filled with Dairy Queen ice cream. It's been filled with every liquid known to man. It's been a bait bucket on fishing for expedition. In fact, the only thing that's ever been turned down that I'm aware of is that a player who has not been named has asked to take it skydiving, and the Hall of Fame said no to that. And they've also decreed that it can no longer, and I say no longer because it's already been there, in strip clubs and gambling institutions. It's not allowed to go in there. But other than that, you know, they've been pretty open-minded about allowing players to do that. And what's interesting is I think it says a lot about a player and what they choose to do with the cup. And, you know, Pat Verbeek, for example, took it to Mass. He was a very religious man, and he just thought he wanted to merge his religion with his other religion, and he did it there. Almost every player, though, that I interviewed, and I found this interesting, always takes it back to where it all began, the local hockey rink. He takes it to his hometown, and they have a little fundraising there, effort there, so that you know, his local hockey association can make a little money.
I think it's remarkable that the player who wanted to take the cup skydiving asked permission.
Well, you got to do that because, you know, you do have the keeper of the cup, and those guys never sleep.
They follow you everywhere.
They follow you everywhere, and, you know, they're sort of the bodyguard for the cup. And believe it or not, even though there are all these rules that are sort of floating out there about no one should raise the cup unless they've won it, and you can only be handed the cup by someone who has won the cup, most of the keepers, you know, have their own standards. You know, as Walt Newbrand said to me, and he's a keeper of the cup, if Nick Lidstrom wants, you know, his wife to hold the cup, and she walks over and picks it up, who am I to say I didn't win the cup, Nick did? And I find that, you know, refreshing. And I think they're all, you know, pretty calm about it. The only player who's lost his cup privileges that I'm aware of is Dominic Hasek. You know, Dominic, they had asked him not to put the Stanley Cup in the pool because, you know, the chlorine does a little damage. And now since the famed Bork episode, they've tried to be careful about that. And that puck and the cup did end up in the pool. And because of that, it was removed from the house. But Jiří Šlégr, who was attending the party in the Czech Republic, pleaded with the cup keeper that, you know, they were about to take it to the center square and in Prague, and that their 30,000 people would be disappointed. So the cup keeper said, well, we can't disappoint 30,000 people. So the cup was brought back, and all's well that ends well. Dominic Hasek made a nice speech at in Prague, and, you know, the cup was allowed to stay.
It's perhaps appropriate to conclude this discussion with a mention of current superstar Sidney Crosby, who was photographed sleeping with the Stanley Cup after the Penguins won it in 2009. Did anybody else sleep with the cup before there were cell phones around to so conveniently make a record of it?
Well, absolutely. Actually, many people have done that. The first that I'm aware of is Brian Trotche, who slept with it, obviously, in the 1980s. I know Steve Yzerman did with Detroit as well. But, you know, the cell phone photo age has upped the ante, and players are all aware of that. You know, because within 15 hours of the Penguins winning the cup and Crosby sleeping with it, it was all over the internet, including photos of the cup being back in Mary Lemieux's pool, you know, where it shouldn't have been because they don't really want it in the pool anymore. But I think players are well aware of that, and they live with that now every day. But I know I talked to Sid about it, and he did say that, you know, you're going to have to be cognizant of that as you move forward because, you don't want to come across as being too irreverent, even though that's, you know, part of the history of the Stanley Cup.
Kevin Allen is the author of Then Wayne Said to Mario, The Best Stanley Cup Stories Ever Told. It's published by Triumph. He joined me from WDET in Detroit. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
A briefer version of my conversation with Kevin Allen about his new book, Then Wayne Said to Mario, the best Stanley Cup stories ever told, will be featured in this week's program. By downloading our podcast, you've just heard the less expurgated edition of that conversation, and I say, good for you. On Saturday, I'll also be talking to Kelly Kulick. Last weekend, she became the first female bowler to best the boys at the Pro Bowlers Association Tournament of Champions. I'll also be speaking with Pat Forte about various recent developments in men's college basketball. Pat's in Kentucky, and we'll see if he's fallen under the spell of Coach John Caligula. I'm sorry, John Calipari down there. We'll have a story about the latest strategy the Milwaukee Bucks have employed in their attempt to lure fans to their games, and I'll visit with some young and very young cross-country skiers and the Olympian who has lent his name to their organization, Bill Koch. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.